we're ready for a cruise. We have this ship of sadhana now, laden with treasure, full of ballast from the Veda, from the Upanishads, the Gita, the whole of the tantric tradition. Everything is on board. We're ready to start looking at Sri Aurobindo's magnum opus, The Life Divine. We're not going to start for a couple of weeks, close to the birthday of Sri Aurobindo, 15th of August. On the 17th, we'll actually begin our coverage with the first chapter. But there's a prelude. We saw, when we looked at the Rig Veda, that the idea of the sacrifice, which is central to the whole of Vedic civilization, has its truest placement inside the aspirant. This is made more and more visible in passing ages. The offering that we make is always symbolic of ourselves. The ascent of our consciousness into a communion with the powers of the cosmos, with that from which the cosmos is an expression, speaks to the depth of our offering. How much of ourselves we are willing to give, that's how much we can receive. That's how great a unity we can come into accord with. And when we looked at the Upanishads, they're even more direct than the Veda. They speak outright, all this is Brahman. Everything is divine. The asuras, the gods, the bird, the old man leaning on his staff, what is above you, what is below you, what is around you, is all that one reality. There is no division. Live in that. Renounce your personal claim. And living in largeness, experience delight. Go beyond mere pleasuring. Go beyond suffering by living in an ocean of bliss, which is what we experience when we break down the walls of the ego. When we let the will of the world course through us and no longer have a petty, personal motive in what we do. This is accentuated in the Gita. But there, the antinomy between the freed self and the bound world is overcome by adding a still greater dimension than simply the realization of the immaculate self, of the perfect Brahman, because it calls us to a personhood that goes beyond personality, to a reality that goes beyond the impersonality of Brahman, to something unnameable, indefinable, of which all of this is an expression in nature, is itself the outer form of an inner power which is inherently divine. And there is the secret of a supreme being and a supreme nature and the real fount of our souls. Because yes, there is a universal reality, but it does not cancel the individual or personal reality. Rather, it is all from one common source. And this is the great tradition of Vedanta, encapsulated in the Bhagavad Gita. But we went through Buddhism and Jainism, the Shramanic fields where the world is renounced in favor of the realization that lifts us out of specific personal suffering, There is a truth in that, but the Tantra called us back to a still greater truth, that you can live in moksha, in a state of mukti, but also recognize that this world is an expression of a vibrant power which is conscious, which is full of delight, and that Shakti, the great power, the Mahashakti, is what breathes itself into this, and at the base you can have bhukti as well as mukti, great delight and enjoyment in the world, which is beautiful and not simply a scene of suffering. Enlarge your consciousness, become one with the all, and as you become oceanic, suffering disappears. Pardon me, it seems my voice is a little light tonight for such a heavy topic. So with all of this gathered into us, we looked at the bhakti tradition. Bhakti is commonly thought of as being simply devotional. Love the divine. Nonsense. Bhakti wants you to become one with the divine in every aspect of yourself. To know the divine, to love the divine, to become one in feeling and sensation, to act out that oneness bodily, is the field, the root of the perfect bhakta. So, with all of this, we see a consummation of the Indian spiritual tradition boiled down to oneness. To move from division to unity, to move from unconsciousness to full consciousness, to move from insentience and suffering to delight, to discover sat-chit-ananda. Because when you really are aware of yourself, what you really are, you experience delight. Sat is existence. Chit is consciousness. Ananda is delight. And that you are. So, Sri Aurobindo, in his yogic vision, also insists on oneness, but a oneness that does not ignore the world, that does not allow us to isolate ourselves in a rapt bliss, that we should remain engaged in the world, as the Gita says, for loka sangraha, for the holding together of the world. Because how we live from a yogic consciousness has a big impact on all that is around. So, to perfect life, not to renounce it, is what Sri Aurobindo envisages. When he came back from England, you will know his biography already, in 1893, having finished with Cambridge, he returned without the idea of practicing yoga, but nascent in him was the idea of gaining liberation for his country, to throw off the yoke of the British tyranny. And as I never tire of saying, when the English arrived in India, she was the richest country in the world. And when the British left India in 1947, she was among the poorest. I'll let you do the arithmetic. Sri Aurobindo became interested in yoga first because he heard that it gave power. And he thought, if I could get power to liberate my country, it's worth the effort. And so the first thing he began to practice was pranayama. And he had no competent guru. He just started doing it for hours and hours a day. Pranayama is a dangerous practice, even when guided by a guru, to do so much of it. And when he became irregular about his practice, he was sick for a period of 6 months before he recovered. And basically through all of 1907, he felt a great want of energy and did not feel the power to go forward in his yogic practice. I should say, that is not the complete picture, because Sri Aurobindo had early experiences, even before leaving England, of what would become full spiritual realizations later. When he was reading Max Müller's translations of the Upanishads in London, he suddenly had the mental realization of what is the nature of the Atman, the silent self. But a mental picture is not the thing itself. And he knew the difference. When he arrived in Bombay by ship in 1893 on the Apollo Bandar, as he stepped onto the soil of Indra, of India, he felt a great peace descend into him from above, and a darkness that had weighed upon him like a blanket of inertia since he had left at the age of 7 for England suddenly get lifted. So there was peace and light again for the first time in many years. When he was in Kashmir, he experienced the vacant infinite. When he was on the shores of the Narmada, looking at an image of Kali, he felt the indwelling Godhead there. When he was riding in a carriage and there was a danger of an accident, he felt welling up from within him an unknown Godhead, which then receded from his view. So he had tastes, he had glimpses of what later would come. But he never practiced yoga until he took up pranayama. What really interested him was when his brother was terribly sick and looked like he was on the verge of passing away. And they sent for a tantric to come. And the tantric simply walked into the room, looked at him, took a cup of water, and made the sign of an X over it and said, "Here, drink this." Brin drank it and started getting well immediately. Sri Aurobindo then knew there must be power in yoga. So he thought to try. As I said, he had that early experience with pranayama. By the way, one of the results that he reported from that was that although he was a natural poet, he could write on his own maybe 4 or 5 good lines a day. But after practicing pranayama, his head was filled with prakasha, with light, a mental light, and he could write hundreds of lines, extended expiations of poetry, without letter hindrance. So that was remarkable to him, kind of energy and illumination it brought. But he had quit doing it. He continued with his revolutionary work. You'll know that he was trying deliberately with all of his being to arouse India to an awareness that politically they could expel the British. And he was a leader in the Nationalist Party, which had a great gathering at Surat in late 1907. He was there from around the 24th of December on to the end of the year. And at the close of that, he was the most prominent leader of nationalist movement in the country. Somebody got word to him that there was a guru who might be willing to work with him, given his difficult schedule. So this man, Vishnu Bhaskar Lele, came to meet with Sri Aurobindo at a friend's house. And he said, I can teach you. I'll teach you meditation. He said, but you have to give me 3 days of your time. And Sri Aurobindo said, I have speeches every day. I have to meet with people constantly. How can I give? He said, well, when you can find 3 days to give to me, then I'll work with you. So eventually Sri Aurobindo was able to arrange for that in the city of Baroda. And he went to a friend's roof and sat in a dwelling up there. And Lele said, sit. Now, close your eyes. Just look. Look at your mind. You'll see that thoughts don't arise within your head, but they come circling in from outside. Sri Aurobindo had never thought of that. He said, immediately, his mind became like a windless sky, vast, and he was simply watching. And then a thought would try to come in. Lele said, every time a thought comes in, you catch it and you throw it out. So within 3 minutes, Sri Aurobindo had realized what is the silence behind the manifestation of this world. Within 3 days, his time with Lele, he had completely silenced the mind. There was no ripple, no rupture to that silence. Now here is a key point. What he experienced was a blowing out of the world existence. There was only this enormous, infinite, vast vacancy. You couldn't name what it was, but the world looked cinematographic, you know, like you were standing outside of it, apart from it. And that world had undergone a nirvana, an extinction into some Brahman existence. So, he had to go back and speak. He had to continue his political career. And he said to Lele, how can I speak in this condition? Lele said, walk to the platform and wait. Something will suggest itself to you. And he did. He walked up there and he saw, as he passed, a newspaper which had a headline. It made an impression on him. He got up there and he made a speech on nationalism, which greatly moved the audience. It's one of his greatest speeches. And the words did not arise from the paper. They just, in a sense, flowed into him from above. This is crucially important because it shows that despite the cessation of ego involvement, one can still work in the world from a spiritual consciousness. Even with the annulment of that sense of person, one can still work in the world, and he did. Continually meeting innumerable people, giving speech after speech after speech. He did this for days and months. In early 1908, and this was his first great realization. Now, interestingly, this idea of a reality that lies behind what seems to be a figment of reality in the front later became absorptive and brought the world into it, so that the world was not excluded from that realization. This deepened in May 1908, just a few months later, 4 months later. This first realization happened in January 1908. A realization which, for many fields of spiritual discipline, would have meant the end of the practice. You get that, you're done. Sri Aurobindo had it in 3 minutes. For most, that's the end. Sri Aurobindo kept going. And when he was arrested by the British on charges which a year later would collapse, he was put for a period of time in solitary confinement, and he sat there And as things became clear to him, he heard something like an inner voice suggesting to him, I tried to tell you that I have other work for you. I tried to get you to leave the political field, but you think you're so important that you think India will not be free unless you do it. Do you understand that I'm in charge of things and I'm going to take care of it? I have better personalities who are more suitably fitted for this job than you. So I'm going to teach you what I want you to do. And among the things that came to him while he was in prison and practicing was a copy of the Gita. And he started reading it for the first time with a different eye. And he said, ah, I see what it's trying to tell me. And then this voice, which was becoming, you know, clear as a higher self to him, said, there are stages and ranges of consciousness which lie above. But look at the world around. And as he looked, he saw in the warden, Vasudeva. He looked at the magistrate. He saw the face of Krishna. He looked at the compound, at the walls around him. That too was Vasudeva. Everywhere he looked, he saw the face of the divine, not a blank, abstract existence, but a conscious existent, a person who uses the abstract, who uses the stuff of impersonality to formulate itself and stands at the center of all beings. So this was a positive to pair with what you might say was the negative. Vasudeva, the universal divine, paired with the nirvanic Brahman existence. Both of these realizations were part and parcel of his nature while he was still in jail. When he was released, soon thereafter, within a year or so, he made his way down to Pondicherry. A third phase of his yoga was already in development then, which was to realize spirit and matter as one, to take the force of nature, the Shakti behind spirit, and make it part of the sadhana as well. Although he had no knowledge of Tantra, this is the aim of Tantra. He was beginning with a realization based on Vedanta, and now trying to bring synthetically into his yogic practice the whole scope of the tantric disciplines without knowing them. But sort of emerging from within was a scheme of yoga which would aim at establishing the principle of peace throughout his being. Not just shanti, though, not just samatha, which is equality to all things, but sukham, an inbuilt happiness, a sukham that from this peace, from this equality, erupts in a divine smile and laughter. That is peace. It is positive, it is dynamic, it liberates through its very touch. And then a principle of power in the yoga, but bringing this power into the body meant, in a sense, reversing things, not living first from the body principle, but living from the divine principle and inviting it down and in, like there's a descent of a higher nature into a lower nature, a secret to natural existence that has to be imported into the very cells of our body. And then avijñāna practice, that is to elevate the consciousness to ranges above and beyond the mind. The mind can't be the summit of conscious existence. Look at the mind. It's bewildered. It can't decide what's real, what's not real. There must be a field of awareness which is true in itself, which is based on truth of being, and so is undivided, undimmed by manifestation. In Sanskrit, that's called vijnana, and in English, Sri Aurobindo called it the supramental. So to reach those layers of supramentality and import that into the being, into peace, into happiness, into the physicality of our life, all of that. And if you can get those three things based on the principle of eternity, based on the trikala drishti, that is the capacity to live in the present, but bring all the riches of the past and be forward moving into the future, all in an eternal now, then you're ready to perfect the body and bring into it health, arogya, so that disease cannot approach it. So that beauty lives from it, radiates from it. And that the body can be the very seat of that principle of sat. We think of sat being at the apex, but sat is secretly at the base of matter. And so satya, truth, should have a material consummation. We should be able to make the body the very field of divine activity. So this was his yoga. And then if that was the third great realization that he had, which came to fulfillment around 1912, then the fourth would be his ascent directly into the supramental consciousness, which he was working on and pulling down all the way to the end of his life in 1950. So we can see, in a sense, telescoped in just a handful of years, the entirety of the Vedantic and the Tantric tradition expressed in his yogic practice, in his actual experience. And then come two visitors from France. A letter has come saying, looks like Sri Aurobindo is going to receive two people from France, from the highest levels of culture there, who want to come and practice yoga with him and take him as their guru. And they were Paul and Mira Richard, who arrived in 1914. Paul, in 1910, had the brief meeting with Sri Aurobindo that changed his life and brought back later, after a period of 4 years, his wife, who was herself already an expert yogini in her own field. So they came to Sri Aurobindo and immediately proposed to him that, we love your philosophy, why not publish it? Why not write about it? So Sri Aurobindo, having said that a yogin should be able to turn his hand at anything, couldn't say no. So they convinced him that he should bring out a journal, and then what to call it. Eventually, after a couple of months, they decided to entitle it Arya, in the original sense of the term, which means the noble, the high-flighted. And it was in August of 1914, 100 years ago this month, that the first issue of Arya was to be presented to the public. It was eventually a financial success as well as a literary success. The British did everything they could to stop its publication. The French were not particularly helpful, but it came out for the first several months in both a French and English edition. We'll speak more about this next week. We have more to prepare for, but today, the 3rd of August, ironically, is I think the day that Germany declared war on France, isn't it? Back in 1914, 100 years ago today. Ironic that as soon as Sri Aurobindo has sent to print this idea of a life divine, the world erupts with a contagion of division. We have not calmed it yet, apparently. But you can't get to outer peace if you don't have inner peace. And so I challenge all yogins and yoginis to make their hearts and minds and bodies the first fields of peace, and that interconnection thereof will be the field in which peace can surely be established. So it's up to us, in other words. You always start at home. So an unusually short talk tonight. But maybe you have some questions you'd like to ask.